listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
So tonight, we celebrate the forthcoming release, celebrate many things, Robin Cost Lewis's extraordinary new poetry collection, The Voyage of the Sable Venus, which will be out probably next year from Knopf. We know it's from Knopf, which is fantastic. And the marvelous news that Claudia Rankine's new collection, Citizen, an American Lyric, is a current finalist for the National Book Award, which is spectacular. Congratulations. Both Claudia and Robin's lyrics lodge feelings, sensations, memories in the body, and the body's response is palpable on the page and in their voices. We first heard Robin Cost Lewis hear it aloud last spring, I believe, during the Poets Memorial to the late Wanda Coleman. Robin's mesmerizing and heartfelt tribute to Wanda, whom she'd never met physically, deeply moved all of us here. Robin has been a Cave Canem Fellow. She holds a degree in Sanskrit from Harvard's Divinity School and is currently a Provost Fellow in Poetry and Visual Studies at USC. And I love Robin's poems because she reminds us that, quote, if the planet had a back door, we'd all still be there waiting for the air to approve our entry. I love her poems because she reminds us that, quote, when God first laid eyes on us, she went mad from envy. In Claudia Rankine's powerful new work, politics and poetry collide, overlay, talk with and through each other. She explores the realm where one's attempts to negotiate a day are complicated by racial interaction in the line at Starbucks, outside the office of a therapist. And those encounters ignite language and emotion and reach us through the truth she finds in her writing. As noted in the recent New Yorker profile, which came out this week, of Claudia, among the antecedents for Citizen are Whitman's Song of Myself, a work that, as Whitman wrote, teaches us to, quote, listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. Citizen is a poem for our time, the time of Michael Brown's death in Ferguson, the time of Trayvon Martin and of Rodney King, a poem that asks us to turn off the distractions and reflect on our shared history in the deepest way. Claudia Rankine, who teaches at Pomona College, is the author of four previous books, including Don't Let Me Be Lonely, an American Lyric. She was the recent recipient of the Jackson Poetry Prize, and that award is, quote, given annually to an American poet of exceptional talent who deserves wider recognition, and we share in that sentiment and are thrilled to present both Robin and Claudia tonight here for the first time at Aloud. Our moderator tonight for the conversation is the amazing Maggie Nelson. She's also a distinguished and daring writer, the author of 9 books of poetry and prose, many of which defy categorization. Among her nonfiction titles are the forthcoming The Argonauts, The Art of Cruelty, A Reckoning, and Blues, which I love to distraction. And among her poetry titles are Something Bright, Then Holes, and Jane, A Murder. And she teaches on the faculty of the School of the Critical Studies at CalArts. We'll start tonight with a reading by Robin Cost Lewis. Please welcome Robin.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Louise. Thank you, Aloud. I love Aloud. I'm always so happy to be here, not for nothing, but the sexy technology. Am I okay?
Sexy technology. Do you want this a little higher?
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you. See what I mean? I mean, you push a button, the podium rises. Give me a break. I love it. There's so much I could say. I could be here tomorrow if I started talking about how much I love Aloud in the LA Public Library and what it's meant to me as a native Los Angeles person. The real reason I'm here, though, let's not front, is because Claudia Rankine has a new book out, and it's a literary event on every level, so I'm very honored to be here and reading with you, Claudia. I love you so much. The first poem I'm going to read is called Felicite. Of all 300 species of hummingbirds, only one, the ruby-throated, crossed the Mississippi. Somehow this matters to me. They can hover in midair. They can fly backwards. They fly 500 miles straight through across the Gulf of Mexico without ever landing. Their mouths are hollow, burnished needles, bright sharp flutes. They sip the nectar of cactus flowers. When Louisiana meant all the land from the Pacific to the Mississippi, a grandmother of mine once owned one of the largest plantations in all the territory. When Louisiana meant Spain, she'd been a slave. When Spain sold itself back, she's listed as the sole owner of a vast plantation, a plantation so large the property lines now form the boundaries of an entire county. Tonight, after 25 years, I realize I've spent my entire life avoiding any situation that might require me to say these words aloud. From the moment I discovered her rotting inside a molding courthouse, her signature next to the plantation's inventory, I began to babble any words I could think of in four different languages, placing them in the most chaotic order possible in order not to say these words. The black side of my family owned slaves. Or her signature, Marie Pani, femme de couleur libre, free woman of color. Her lover was a famous judge from Sardinia. He took great pleasure in watching black women hanged inside the square to musical accompaniment. I read this about him once and tried to see her brown, sleeping next to him, fucking him on her plantation, on her pineapple bed, kissing him behind his ears, sharing an alligator pear, strolling through her cane. Maybe at some point every hour, a part of me has wondered about her silently, though I did not think so until just now. Perhaps she is the answer to this sensation I have had for years, that of another body hovering inside me, waiting for address. What can history possibly say? Sometimes I feel a pride I cannot defend or explain. Sometimes I smile. Into the barbed nectar of the story I've stared my whole life. Whenever someone tried to kiss me, I tucked her name under my tongue. If someone tried too long to hold me, I hid her between my legs. If they wanted to touch me there, I'd pull out her name and place the white bone under my pillow, hoping she would return, take it away, leave me a glistening quarter. To her son, Théodule, Marie Pani gave her favorite slave, a girl named Félicité. They were married. One of their children, Héloïse, was my grandmother's great-great-grandmother. There was a picture I found of her once, corseted in a studio, standing next to a waist-length pillar, which held a verdant fern. But mostly, I have wondered, how does one name a slave happiness? Happiness had a twin sister, Françoise. I don't know what happened to her. Perhaps she is still out there like us, her throat glistening a silent red. Or perhaps she is the only one who can still cross the river, the only one still flying backwards over the Gulf without landing. Thank you. The title poem of my book, The Voyage of the Sable Venus, is taken from a painting. I'm sure many of you are probably aware of this painting. It's too long of a story to go into here, but the poem is about 80 pages long. Don't worry, I'm not going to read it all. Just a few pages of it. And the rules I set for it was an experiment. The rules I set for myself was, if you hear that title, Voyage of the Sable Venus, it makes you wonder, no? And so I started to think about all the titles in the world, in the Western art world, that included a black female figure, and what would happen if I gathered all these titles, say, over a decade, and put them all in a pot, and then tried to create a narrative of the history of the black female figure in Western art. OCD, yes. And so while you won't be able to hear where one title ends and another title begins, what you're listening to are all titles of Western art in which a black female figure is present. None of the titles are repeated. And I think that's all you need to know. It spans from 38,000 BC to the pregnant, exactly, to the present. And I'm going to read from ancient Rome, ancient Greece, some colonial stuff, and some maybe some civil rights stuff, and some little bit of postmodern stuff. It starts with the epigraph. The Metropolitan Museum of Art Employees Association Minstrel Show and Dance will be held at the American Women's Association, 361 West 57th Street, Saturday evening, October 17th, 1936. This is from the Ancient Rome and Ancient Greece catalog. Water jar, bowl, ointment spoon in the form of a swimming black girl. Mirror with handle in the form of a carved standing black girl. Handle of a sistrum, a Bess and Isaiah dancing back to back. Two nails with Negro heads in relief. Head of a Negro witch may have adorned a pin. Mounted in a ring, bezel, bowl. Decorated with three heads in relief, separated by flat vein leaves. Female puppet with mortar and pestle necklace, with two heads of black women forming a clasp. Perfume vase, head of an adolescent, juxtaposing two heads of Negroes cast from the same mold. Mirror with handle in the form of a young Nubian female standing, lamp in the form of the head of a black, perhaps, incense shovel with a Negro head attached to handle, a girl, with long corkscrew curls, round face wide, flat nose and mouth open and jutting forward to form a spout, an inkwell in the form of a crouching Negro, Negro sitting, writing on a scroll. This is from... Let's see, this is from the postmodern period. Dick and Jane with me, page spread, the upper room, two flip side self. Untitled female drinking figure, a reclining silent protest parade, the result of the 15th Amendment ritual and revolution self-possession. Invisible black Russians, girls with guns, linen watch from the tower. This is my life, cutting up old film. Don't edit the wrong thing out. Untitled World's Exhibition being the narrative of a Negress in the flames of desire. What remains? Pandora Mechanical Girl. Rabbit hole, fingerprints, secrets, tales of amnesia. I see it every day, the conscience of the court, woman in interiors, plate one, wedding night, untitled Venus looking in the mirror. The black woman asked, mirror, mirror, on the wall, who's the finest of them all? The mirror says, Snow White, you black bitch, and don't you forget it, Sphinx. 25, this is also from the postmodern period. Darky town rebellion, tit for tat brooch, cut beam burn, balance consume, the rich soil down there, the bush shin deboning, you don't know where her mouth has been. Stars and fireworks, woman feeding bird woman, brushing hair, Bathsheba at the fountain, Venus before a mirror, three wishbones in a wooden box. Hip hip hooray, look away, look away. They was nice white folks while they lasted, says one gal to another. I think I'll end here with Plantation. It's not a part of the title poem, Voyage of the Sable Venus. It's just an occasional poem. Thank you so much for coming, Claudia. My heart knows no bounds. I'm very, very, very honored to share the stage with you. Plantation. And then one morning we woke up, embracing on the bare floor of a large cage. To keep you happy, I decorated the bars. Because you had never been hungry, I knew I could tell you the black side of my family owned slaves. I realize this is perhaps the one reason why I love you, because I told you this and you still wanted to kiss me. We laughed when I said plantation, fell into our chairs when I said cane. There were fingers on the floor and the split bodies of women who'd been torn apart by horses during the Inquisition. You'd said, well, I'll be damned. Every now and then, you change from a prancing black buck into a small, high yellow girl, pigtailed, patent leather, eye-spinning gossamer, begging for egg salad and banana pudding. Or just as quickly, you'd become the girl's mother, pulling yourself away from yourself. Because my whole head was covered with a heaving beehive, you thought I didn't notice. I noticed. I cried, honey. And then you were 14, and you had grown a glorious steel cock under your skirt. To brag, you rubbed yourself against me. Then your tongue was inside my mouth, and I wanted to say, please ask me first. But it was your tongue, so who cared suddenly about your poor manners? We had books, and a waterfall was falling in the corner. I didn't tell you. I couldn't remember what that thing was you said to me once, that tender thing you'd said I should never forget. The moment you said it, I forgot it. I wondered if you thought we were lost. We weren't lost. We were lost. And meanwhile, all I could think about was the innumerable ways I would have loved to have eaten you, how being devoured can make one cry. And I hoped you liked the pleasant, fresh taste of juiced cane. You pulled my pubic bone toward you. I didn't say it's still broken. I didn't tell you there's still this crack. It was sore, but I stayed silent because you were smiling. You said, the bars look pretty, baby, and rubbed your hind legs up against me. Thank you.
Good evening. Oh, it's so nice to be here. Thank you, Louise. Thank you, Aloud. Thank you, Rob and my sister. We haven't found the papers yet, but they're out there somewhere. I thought I would start with the first paragraph of an essay I wrote. And then I would move to citizen. Since August 9th, when Officer Darren Wilson shot Michael Brown to death, twice in the head and four times in the body, I realize I have been waiting for news of an indictment a part of me doesn't believe is coming. It's the same I don't dare invest feeling I had when Barack Obama ran for president in 2008. In order for Obama to get elected, a significant portion of Americans would have to consider his policies separate from their skin color. It was difficult for me to place trust in the possibility that this could happen. I wanted it to occur. But I was certainly ready for it not to. After all, as Hillary Clinton pointed out in May 2008, as she was under increased pressure to drop out of the presidential race, and this is a quote, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated in June in California, she said. Anything bad could happen was her point. She would later apologize. I regret that if my referencing that moment of trauma for our entire nation, and in particular the Kennedy family, was in any way offensive, I certainly had no intention of that whatsoever. End of quote. Certainly not. As the remark was directed at Obama. But she brought out into the open something we all know. The black male body is vulnerable in these United States. It is vulnerable in terms of mortality, and it is vulnerable in terms of justice. So I still wait. I hope we're all waiting. I live in Claremont, and in the mornings I walk our dog Sammy, and I walk with a friend. And one day, I told her I was working on Citizen, and I was thinking about the ways in which black bodies and white bodies and brown bodies reposition themselves around each other. And this friend of mine, a white woman, she said, I asked her, what's a moment when you think about yourself as a white woman relative to the black body? And we walked up the mountain. It's a 5-mile walk. So we were walking up the mountain. You go 2.5 miles up, 2.5 miles down. And as we were going up, she was like, I can't think of anything. And then we got to the gazebo and we were coming down. And she said, I know. It's when I see a black man and the seat next to him is empty. And I said, wait, I do that too. So this was the piece that I wrote. On the train, the woman standing makes you understand there are no seats available. And in fact, there is one. Is the woman getting off at the next stop? No. She would rather stand all the way to Union Station. The space next to the man is a pause in a conversation you are suddenly rushing to fill. You step quickly over the woman's fear, a fear she shares. You let her have it. The man doesn't acknowledge you as you sit down because the man knows more about the unoccupied seat than you do. For him, you imagine, it is more like breath than wonder. He has had to think about it so much, you wouldn't call it thought. When another passenger leaves his seat and the standing woman sits, you glance over at the man. He is gazing out the window into what looks like darkness. You sit next to the man on the train, bus, in the plane, waiting room, anywhere. He could be forsaken. You put your body there in proximity to, adjacent to, alongside, within. You don't speak unless you are spoken to, and your body speaks to the space you fill, and you keep trying to fill it, except the space belongs to the body of man next to you, not to you. Where he goes, the space follows him. If the man left his seat before Union Station, you would simply be a person in a seat on the train. You would cease to struggle against the unoccupied seat. When, where, why, the space won't lose its meaning. You imagine if the man spoke to you, he would say, "It's okay, I'm okay. You don't need to sit here. You don't need to sit," and you sit and look past him in the darkness. The train is moving through a tunnel. All the while, the darkness allows you to look at him. Does he feel you looking at him? You suspect so. What does suspicion mean? What does suspicion do? The soft gray-green of your cotton coat touches the sleeve of him. You are shoulder to shoulder. Though standing, you could feel shadowed. You sit to repair whom? Who? You erase that thought. And it might be too late for that. It might forever be too late or too early. The train moves too fast for your eyes to adjust to anything beyond the man, the window, the tile tunnel, its slick darkness. Occasionally a white light flickers by like a displaced sound. From across the aisle tracks, room, harbor, world, a woman asks a man in the rows ahead if he would mind switching seats. She wishes to sit with her daughter or son. You hear, but you don't hear. You can't see. It's then the man turns to you, the man next to you turns to you. And as if from across inside, and as if from inside your own head, you agree that if anyone asks you to move, you'll tell them, we are traveling as a family. This book has a series of microaggressions, or those small moments that bodies negotiate all the time, black bodies, brown bodies. I think white women know it because they're women. I don't know what the equivalent is for white men. Maybe you can tell me. But that sense of not owning the space, having the space move you around, in a sense. You're in the dark, in the car, watching the black, tarred street being swallowed by speed. He tells you his dean is making him hire a person of color when there are so many great writers out there. You think maybe this is an experiment and you are being tested or retroactively insulted, or you have done something that communicates this is an okay conversation to be having. Why do you feel comfortable saying this to me? You wish the light would turn red, or a police siren would go off, or you could slam on the brakes, slam into the car ahead of you, fly forward so quickly, both your faces would suddenly be exposed to the wind. As usual, you drive straight through the moment with the expected backing off of what was previously said. It is not only that confrontation is headache-producing, it is also that you have a destination that doesn't include acting like this moment isn't inhabitable, hasn't happened before, and that before isn't part of the now, as the night darkens and the time shortens between where we are and where we are going. Thank you so much.
Gosh, couldn't you guys hear so much more? It's like, oh my gosh, I feel like just, let's just keep listening. But that's not on the agenda. So, all right, you guys, welcome everybody. I really can't tell you how honored I am. I don't even know how I ended up here, but I'm just so honored to be here, to be asking you guys questions. You know, I'm sad that Robin, we have to wait another whole year. It's exactly a year. Right? But I have Robin's book in this blue folder, so I'm very lucky, and I'm very lucky to have spent time with both of these books. They're very important books, as you all already know. I thought we might start off by talking a little bit about, I mean, you both have these titles, Citizen, an American Lyric, and then Voyage of the Sable Venus, which seem like that they just bear a little more time to talk about. And I guess, you know, the night here is called The Poet is Citizen, and we could stay here till really late talking about those four words, right? Mm-hmm. But I thought, since both of your books were concerned with history, maybe it would not seem two out there to begin with a quote that I came across recently from the 1860s from a senator from Massachusetts, of all places, Senator John Davis, who said this during the session of Congress. It's the session of Congress that eventually enacted the 1866 Civil Rights Act. He says, Senator Davis, "My position is that this is a white man's government. It was made so at the beginning. I say that the Negro is not a citizen. He may be made a citizen by power, but it will be in disregard, I think, of principle. I guess I'm drawing this out just because it seems so, this difference between being made a citizen by power and then having that status, you know, disregarded of principle remains abundantly with us today, and it seems very close to the concerns of both of your books in different ways. I wonder, Claudia, if you want to say something about your angle on such concerns and also about the tone of when you say citizen, you know, one can hear insistence, plea, outrage, critique, and I just wonder how you, and then Robin, I want to hear, we'll move to talking about your title in a minute. But.
The title, citizen, I like that you begin with the law and begin with history, because I think, for me, the problem starts with the fact that we as in black people, started out as property. And it's as if that fact cannot be released. It's the thing that just keeps glomming on despite the centuries turning over. And so I agree that the way in which it was posed for the book was a kind of insistence, which makes me sad, actually, because I don't like being put in that position of having to ask for something I have.
Exactly.
I mean, maybe Robin, I mean, you can talk about that too, but just also just,
sure, it's kind of related to my title. So my title, Voyage of the Sable Venus, is the title of a painting, The Voyage of the Sable Venus. It's a colonial painting. It's a gorgeous painting. It is a sick, heinous painting as well. It is a redux of the Venus on the clamshell, except the figure is a black woman. She's drawn through the water by Cupids and other Greek classical figures, Neptune, etc. And so when you first see the painting, at least for me, I'm like, wow, right? But then you look closely and Neptune is carrying the flag of the Union Jack. So it's a pro-slavery painting. And so, I know, right? And so you have this incredible, like, yeah, right? And that felt very much to me what it feels like to be a citizen in this country, because there's all this mythology and rhetoric and history that is without doubt. I mean, you know, democracy is a great idea. We know some maybe century will reach it, I don't know. But, you know, but at the same time, you know, this land is saturated in blood, so much blood. And so, you know, so that's where the title comes from. It also seemed to me to tell the story of the black female figure in Western art as well.
And also, though, I wonder, I mean, because your book, I mean, you all don't know this yet, but your book has a lot of poems that, I mean, we kind of begin as a traveler with the speaker of the poems traveling far and wide, and there's a real sense of journey throughout the whole book of this arc. So in some ways, obviously, there's a canny, I mean, I wouldn't even call it a reclamation, but there's a use, an employment the journey, I mean, of the voyage for the speaker, so I don't know.
Right, I mean, I think it's also an interior journey as well of what does it mean to inhabit a black female body in this country in this time. And, you know, it feels very autobiographical, even though it's about the major movement of the book is about Western art, but it feels very autobiographical. I remember someone said, well, you know, it's not really a debut book. And I was like, of course it is. That is my autobiographical, you know, that is it. It's stuck here of what it means not to inhabit the space, not to have a space to inhabit, though you are in space. I mean, it is a very strange, to put it mildly, kind of interior struggle to will yourself into history when history tells you you do not exist. Sensation does not exist. Personhood does not exist. You are not a person. It's a very strange experience. And so it does work autobiographically as well. Yeah, thank you for that.
I mean, that really seems like, I mean, Claudia, there's a piece in your book where you talk about, you describe a friend's theory, and the friend's theory is that, you know, something called our historical selves kind of stand ready to do battle at any given moment with something the friend calls our self-selves. And I don't know, I'm not 100% going to stand behind this binary per se, so I'm glad if you all want to mess it up. But your book nonetheless does focus on scenes in which the chafing between these two entities, or the merging, which, that chafing runs the gamut. It can be, at times, it's irritating, at times it's saddening, and at times it's, murderous on, and you focus on instances in which it's really laid bare. Whereas Robin, I think, in reading your poems, and I'm really glad you read Plantation and Felicite tonight, because I think both those poems really broadcast this, but that, you have a lot of poems that either... they're either intimate scenes that braid history, as in the first opening lines of that, and then one morning we woke up embracing on the bare floor of a large cage, or else you have actually poems that are like self-portrait as, and then a figure, or a projective imagining, like the poem you have, 1951 scene of Jim, it's a 1951 scene, Jim Crow welcomes you home to the Grand Canyon just after midnight. So I guess, I'm interested in, you're both doing experiments with this historical self and the self-self. Again, feel free to demolish that binary, but you're both doing work with that, and I wonder if you might say what it feels like as you're creating, as you're writing, negotiating those selves. Are they separate? Do they speak differently? I don't know. Just how does it...
Well, one of the things I am jealous of in Robin's work is the way in which she's created in the poems a kind of intimate space in which these bodies can connect. I think in my own work was thinking about public space, more or less, and the sense of relationships, because we talk, these poems are about these kinds of these incoherent moments that kind of throw us up into surprise and startle us into looking at the other person as another suddenly, but the only reason that happens is because you want to be intimate with the person who's in front of you. You want the relationship. It's not that you don't want it. You want it. And so when it seems broken or it seems like the person doesn't see you, it's a surprise and it's a disappointment. And so I was really interested in bringing and making transparent the moments of the break as I saw them, the moments when you step back and think,
I don't know, I'm going off script, so I'm not sure I'm going to get this right, but you're working on Baldwin, so you would know, but in The Fire Next Time, I mean, doesn't he have, though, that line where he says, like, what black people want from white people is their power. but what white people want from black people is love.
Well, he says that the only thing black people should want from white people.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Is their
right,
power.
I see. Okay.
Do you want me to answer the history self question?
No, if you want to,
Well, I love what Claudia was just saying. As per usual, it's like these complicated issues get really pared down to the fact of the matter is, and it's pain, I think. This is a part of me that's a disco head, right? That there should be disco balls always in our day. And we should be dancing all the time. But there's so much love in the world. I hate to go hippie on you. I'm going hippie. There's so much love in the world. There's so much love between people. I mean, don't let me be lonely ends on a handshake. Like, I extend my hand to you. And the sad part of that historical self moment is the hand is usually not only not shaken, but chopped off or burned or put up in a museum as an exhibit. Yeah. And that's the tragedy there, is that we're still not even communicating, not even touching, not to mention touching and talking. Mm-hmm. I think with regard to my work, where is the self in my work? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm starting, for the last, say, decade, I've been thinking that I don't really exist. I mean that in a good way, not mm-hmm. in the historical sense. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm a piece of history. I am a manifestation of history, mm-hmm. and that interests me greatly rather mm-hmm. than the individual. Mm-hmm. You know, Elizabeth Alexander is constantly, in really brilliant ways, talking mm-hmm. about this conversation that's been happening in African American poetry for a while, how mm-hmm. every eye is a dramatic eye. Mm-hmm. That very much mm-hmm. Concerns me in my work, where I try to use mm-hmm. my own geography, my own life, whatever, mm-hmm. as a historical self to kind of mm-hmm. think about these issues on the page. Mm-hmm. But myself, I mean, mm-hmm. God, I think mm-hmm. that she's medieval and lives off mm-hmm. a few millennia back. Mm-hmm. I think that's why a lot of it shows up in my work, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I like thinking about our lives historically. I think it allows me to mm-hmm. do much more on the page mm-hmm. in terms of the personal being political mm-hmm. and all that than, you know, mm-hmm. talking about, like, mm-hmm. whatever, my mother.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because what you're both describing in a way is, you know, if you're writing out of a sense that you don't exist, or you're talking about the moments at which you are continually disassociated from the sense that you have any claim upon space, or as mm-hmm. you say, being moved around, you know, but the thing is that, I mean, it's just very interesting because it doesn't, writing from that space does not indicate silence. It indicates you're writing, you know? Right. So it's, I don't know. It just seems like there's a lot that's fertile there that goes against nearly every yeah. tradition that you hear about how one comes to, you know, all the claptrap about finding and owning a voice in a space and all that, you know?
You know, I'm happy not to exist, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But I'm not happy not to exist at the expense of other people existing for me. Mm-hmm. That's the difference on the page.
Yeah.
That's it.
Did you want to say anything, Claudia? No. She said it. Yeah. I mean, I want to ask, I mean, a lot of you probably have read Citizen already, and if you haven't, you know, it's for sale in the lobby, along with Don't Let Me Be Lonely. But also, but you know, Robin's book, like I said, I've had the chance to look at. But I just want to talk for a minute about them as books, maybe just as from this idea of not only from whence or one is writing, but also what you're making. And I think it's interesting because the Voyage of the Sable Venus, this very long poem, kind of conceptual project like you described, stands at the center of your book. And I kept thinking in my mind, every time I think about Citizen, I think about this excellent essay on Serena Williams as being at its center, even though every time I look at the book, I realize it comes very early on and doesn't really occupy its literal heart, but I just keep thinking that it does. And I wonder, but Robin's book has all kinds of poems in and around the Sable Venus, you know, centerpiece. And then Claudia's book has, I mean, like I said, many of you may know these scripts pieces, a visual art component, this excellent essay on Serena Williams, these microaggression incidents. So I'm just wondering if both of you might speak a little bit to, you know, deciding on the parameters of your book, what went in, what didn't make it, what should stand where in it and why. You know.
Well, I should start out by saying that I started out this day watching Serena play a match against, who is she playing? Goodness, I don't even remember. But she won, so that was that's what mattered. But yesterday she lost, and the commentators, it was really interesting. One of the commentators said, well, I know there's this argument that she's the best, but it seems to me that if she was the best, she wouldn't let things bother her. Because clearly she played very badly yesterday. And it's because, it might be because the Russian guy said she was, he referred to the Williams brothers, referring to Serena and Venus. And that was a distraction. But other people have had distractions, and they've gone on to win. So I, you know, it makes me wonder if she's the best, if she can't get over these things when she gets on the court. And so that was part of the morning, the morning discussion as she was winning today. So I think, Serena, that essay, it's amazing to me that she is out in the world publicly fighting the battle of all black women mm-hmm. every day. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, I don't really think of it as the centerpiece. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think of it that way. It just seemed as if she was emblematic of all of us. Mm-hmm. And so that's, in a sense, why it came early on. Mm-hmm. The people kept, when I wrote the book and I sent it to friends, you being one of them, you know, a number of people said, well, you should take out the Serena Williams essay and just put in more microaggression. So it was one of those moments where
add microaggression here.
add more of those and get rid of the Serena essay. And I always found that interesting, and I think it had to do with the fact that the essay is about being angry. Mm-hmm. And how anger maybe is an appropriate response. Mm-hmm. So I'm rambling, mm-hmm. but
no, I think that's why probably in my mind affectively is at the center, because the tone of that essay is one that exalts in some ways, and like in you know when she says, you know, I'm gonna shove this fucking ball down your throat, and because the speaker of so many of the pieces throughout Citizen, as when the one you read says, as per usual, I'm going to
keep
driving, and you know, I think at one point you even say like that's what being a citizen means, you know, move on, let it go, and that piece is about, you know, she's fighting, like you say, fighting it out every mm-hmm. day, you mm-hmm. know.
So, the hard thing was getting out of the book, because there was, mm-hmm. there, I think one thinks narratively of resolving the problem of the book at the end of the book. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's no resolution, mm-hmm. Because it is what it is, it's our lives. So trying to think about how to leave mm-hmm. was took the longest time mm-hmm. in terms of the organization of the book. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You wanted me to talk about the structure?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay. So, originally it was just going to be this long poem, mm-hmm. Voyage of the Sable Venus, which is some of the work I read from. And then we decided to add some poems. And so the first section is what I call the sick poems. Mm. And the latter section is... I think they're poems that really are about childhood mm-hmm. for the most part, mm-hmm. but not childhood, like they're childhood poems. It's about like, mm-hmm. you know, I grew up in Compton, speaking of Serena Williams, very proud, just saying, and Venus.
You are Serena Williams.
and trying to figure out how to talk about the mythology of innocence within the context of childhood, particularly, I think for all children, I just don't believe in innocence, but especially for, you know, I grew up being shot at constantly by the LAPD, constantly, it was just normative. We used to play hopscotch with the shells from the bullets. They used to roll down our street with their guns resting on the windows, like for sport. And so then, you know, that whole Blake thing, songs of innocence, songs of experience, it becomes very complicated when you're being shot at as a child in LA by the police. You know, this whole notion of safety. And so so these two things about, you know, I mean, I didn't even know I felt this way until just now, but mm-hmm. the first part is about the mythology of innocence being completely shattered. Mm-hmm. That poem Plantation is about that. I used to joke with friends that I wanted to title that Love American Style based on the Love Boat, but I didn't think anybody would get it. Like, is love actually possible in the United States? I mean, it's a sad state about my psychological state, but I just don't know that it's true. I mean, I don't, because of the microaggressions that Claudia talks about in her book, even in your bed, right? You roll over and then suddenly... the bed opens up and there's an abyss. I mean, it happens all the time. And so then the third part of it is, I think, an attempt to try, to still try, mm-hmm. to somehow find a floor mm-hmm. when there is no floor, mm-hmm. Even in childhood, just to try to find, like, mm-hmm. is there a way for me mm-hmm. to find something? Mm-hmm. I mean, my favorite part of the last chapter is a poem about my father's death. Mm-hmm. My father was a cool cat. And, you know, the thing I keep saying to my editor is there must be black joy in this book, no matter what. I know it's a mm-hmm. very dark book, and I like that. But how to, not in an American way, tie up a bow at the end and make the book happy, I don't care about that at all. But how to say emphatically, I feel very lucky mm-hmm. that I was born to the parents I was born to and the place I was born to, bullets notwithstanding, that there was something very magical that occurred mm-hmm. in that house that mm-hmm. stands up to the heinous history of the moment. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it works. I'm still not sure. I'm still trying to figure that part out.
I mean, it's interesting what you say, though, about, I mean, the fundamental and totally shared by me skepticism about that. I mean, we were talking about that chasm of relating, mm-hmm. and it seems to relate to what Claudia is talking about, you know, in your book, the refrain over and over again, you know, did you just say that? Did I just hear that? And, you know, always this chasm. But what's so, you know, interesting is that, you know, your poems, I mean, maybe I just feel like this is as good as it gets or something, but they feel like that they, but you know, I, but I, they feel palpably like that there is communication mm-hmm. going on, mm-hmm. even if it's a communication to your father that he was a cool cat, or a communication to what past self one has been, you know. And then in Claudia's work, I mean, even though you have these layers about the second person and these kind of, you know, collected stories that almost make any body that appears seem like it has like three or four bodies kind of vibrating out of it at one yeah. time, there's something about, it's not between the people, but it's between the reader and the work, where there's an intimacy that is experienced, you know, vis-a-vis the second person that feels very, I mean, I guess I'm just meaning to say that the encounter is happening. It's just happening vis-a-vis the poetry in mm-hmm. a way, even if it's representing something that's mm-hmm. not working as encounter.
Yeah.
Well, the use of the second person mm-hmm. was intentional, because I wanted the reader to always have to position themselves relative mm-hmm. to the text, mm-hmm. so that you would have to say, this you does not belong to me, mm-hmm. or this you must be a black person, mm-hmm. this you must be a white person. I because, you know, there's that sense that, or there is the rhetoric that exists that says those things don't matter. I don't think about race. People are just people. And yet, in order to understand what you're reading, you're going to have to figure out, is this a man? Is this a woman? Is this mm-hmm. a black person? Is this what? Is mm-hmm. this me? Did I do this? Did I ever do this? Would I ever do this? And so that second person was meant to move the reader around. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, yes, it's an encounter, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to say one other thing. Mm-hmm. Why this moment for me is a very special moment, right now, mm-hmm. right this minute, mm-hmm. is because these two people are two of my best readers. and I mean, not now. I mean, in the making of the work. Mm. They're both women who I trust when they come back and say, why'd you do this? Or how does this work? And I think the reason that is that both of them see human beings, but in their full selves, without having to take away anything. In fact, they give more to the self than maybe even the self deserves. So I want to I want to take this public moment to thank you both.
Oh, that's very nice.
Thank you.
That's very
nice.
As I suspected, I have like three more pages of questions, but I think that like I said, we could stay here for a long time. Please do, and then we'll ask the audience.
And then I'll shut up.
No.
Another thing that I think is really important to just consider and keep in mind is the visual.
Yeah.
The visual in Claudia's work is just, it's amazing what she did. It's a part of the book. Also, Don't Let Me Be Lonely. Mm-hmm. And also in my book, The Voyage of the Sable Venus, as I said, it's all art titles.
Yeah.
And there's a way in which I was sitting here thinking when you were talking is about how art is a kind of, can be a kind of aggression as it's hanging on a wall, whatever the art is, and how you and I have talked a lot about this and we experience it and we all do, like, you know, there's another thing being telegraphed to us in terms of race via the art that has no language, you know. So I just wanted to throw that out there because visuality is a part of our work.
Yeah, and it's so important because, I mean, for, you know, Claudia's book has these, you know, spectacular reproductions that almost, I mean, she talks about them sometimes, but I also noticed that they kind of accrue as their own argument if you just pay attention to them, you know. And then, but Robin, and then in your work, I mean, that collage archival immersion piece, I mean, what's so remarkable, I guess, is that I don't know if you're planning on having any like thing on the cover or anything. I mean, good. I think not because I think that because what in both cases they kind of become placeholders. In your case, placeholder of that which we can't see. Because if you look up the Voyage of the Sable Venus, as I've been spending a lot of time last week looking at it, I mean, it's like there. It's just like a wallop of appalling information all at once, but to be suspended in the space of you dealing with it verbally and dealing with the titles verbally is very different than seeing it. And then and in your case, the kind of not totally explicated relationship to the visual art, but letting it stand there as almost, you know, just kind of holding its own weight. And it, in both cases, as you say, the visuality is another layer of a kind of a conversation about that which is unspeakable or unseeable in some way.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about representation in a sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to, or to go back to Michael Brown, one of the things that's really interesting to me is the rhetoric the police use again and again, that sense that I had to kill him because I thought he was going to kill me. So that sense of an imaginary perceived danger based on a representation that is not tied to the person in front of you.
Nor does it have to be tied for it to be legally hold water. I just know.
I'm working on this this poem, haiku called, it doesn't have a title, but it goes, because white men can't police their imagination, black men are dying. And I think that goes back to the sense of representation being at the heart of both our works.
Yeah. That seems very true. Well, much as I want to steal you guys for a continuing conversation, but I guess it's a moment at which if people have any questions, maybe we could just take a few. Maybe no more than three or so. But, yeah.
Hello. This is for both of you. I'm curious if you differentiate between finding a space or being put in your place as a black person and as a woman.
I think those things I think those things are totally different for me. I try very hard to resist anybody putting me in my place enough. But I'm not quite sure there is a space, I guess, for any of us, not just me, but for you too. If there isn't a space for me, there certainly isn't a space for you. How could there be? And so it feels like, you know, the geography, the psychological geography of this country is one in which is empty. You know, I always joke with a friend, you know, we're both like, you know, meditators, it's like, be in the present. It's like the present is completely uninhabited. Who's in it? So I would like to find a space, but I guess I don't believe in it yet.
I also think that it's impossible to pull those things apart because the power dynamics that is positioning and repositioning women, blacks, poor people, the same. It's the same. It's the same drive. It's the same desire to be on top.
It's a great question. Thank you.
First of all, thank you so much. Your poetry is really takes my breath away.
Thank you. And
I just wanted to ask if either one of you would like to maybe speak about this. Yesterday, as you may know, there was a national day of protest to stop police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. So in front of the LAPD headquarters in Ferguson, in New York's Times Square and around the country, you know, people came together to hold up the pictures of people who have died by the police and family members speaking about the loss of their loved ones. And a news reporter came up for a brief interview and asked me just one question, and I wanted to kind of get your idea on this. He said, well, you thought there would be thousands of people here, the organizers, but there's only hundreds, so why is it so small? And I just think in broad strokes, maybe, if you'd like to, I'd love to hear what you're thinking.
While you're thinking, can I say something? A lot of the people that would be there are dead. Right? I grew up in a neighborhood. I've just moved back to California. I was born in Compton, grew up in Carson. And it's very strange to be middle-aged back in the neighborhood you grew up in. A group of women and I hang out in my backyard. We have a little wine. It's fun. We talk about how at least 80% of the men, the boys, let me stop, the boys we grew up with are all dead. They're all dead. All of them. And if that had happened to a country, say, it would be called a genocide. It would be called something. It would have a name, right? So I don't know. I mean, that's a stupid question that man asked you to start with. But but it is so ahistorical. It's so ahistorical. You know, I mean, and police brutality is not new. Come on. I mean, are you joking? It's a century old. It's 2 centuries old. It's the history of the police in America is the history of the Klan. It's the history of white supremacy. Why are we pretending? And I'm tired of having these conversations about police brutality that are specific to a year or a decade or even a century. You know, I'm sorry. I can't be articulate about this because it's very close to home. But I don't understand that question that he asked you.
I disagree. We have a moment of disagreement.
Yay. Yeah.
The love is shattered.
No, the told love is, you, yeah. Intimacy cannot exist.
No, you see, I disagree. The love is not shattered. Okay. But we have a moment of disagreement. I think it's a good question. I think it is the question. Where is everybody? We are in a moment of crisis. And because the person on the other side of that gun and on the other side of that foot doesn't look like your son, where are you? I really think we need to ask ourselves, because it's about class, it's about race. Where are you?
I disagree with her. I agree with her completely, but I disagree because a part of me, I just feel like so many people are in some psychological abyss around responding.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay. Out of just utter fatigue, you know? I mean, yeah. No, trauma, not even fatigue, that's the wrong word.
Yeah.
Trauma, you know? You know, you say, well, so-and-so got shot by the cops, and they're like, you know, like, that's it.
I mean, it's all our problem.
No, exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. I think the corrective is great. Like, why aren't there more people out here? But that's not what he was saying.
I don't care what he was saying.
Okay, that's different.
Maybe we'll do one more. You had your hand up a couple of times. Did you want to do it?
So, I haven't read Citizen, but I am really curious about the concept of writing it in the second person, and specifically because you've acknowledged that it addresses microaggressions, I wonder if the choice to write it in the second person is an aggression. And I wonder if is it the dance that we're all doing all the time in negotiating our social lives? And then another question kind of came to me in the last conversation is trauma. Is this sort of social trauma cumulative? And are we experiencing something different than what people, you know, decades ago were experiencing in terms of this kind of like oppression?
Is writing in the second person itself an act of aggression? Is that fair in terms of restating? Yes? It could be, but it also could be an embrace. So I think it depends on how you receive it. I think that in the writing, I was seeing it as an embrace. It was a call. It's like, you, come over here. But if you receive it as you, then that says something, you know what I mean? That's itself its own act. So it's unstable, which is always a good thing.
Well,
because intention then walks in the room. And then do you want to take the second half?
I'm sorry, I was still thinking about the second person question, which is such a great, your point of view is always so fascinating, what it can do. Mm-hmm. Such small words. The second question, I'm sorry, can you say again? Oh, is the trauma, this trauma different from other trauma historically?
Yeah,
is that what you're saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that I can answer that question, honestly, except to say, you know, what I think, but what I think, I don't exist, so what do I know? You know, I have a friend who, Twiley, she wrote the book The Gangster We're All Looking For. It's a brilliant book about the American War in Vietnam and refugeeism. And Twiley, I heard her read once, and somebody was talking to her about the Vietnam War, and she's like, you know, as if America, and she said, well, you know, America is a site that is haunted by a war, but we're still not dealing with it, and it's a civil war. I think I feel that way about your question. There is still so much unattended and so many things that we've yet to address, not just about African Americans, about women, about everyone. This country seems to be this location of recurring silences. And I'm not one that thinks that articulation is so great. I don't think that everything needs to be said. I don't necessarily think that. But I do think that some things need to be addressed, a lot of things. And I think that often what happens is this repetition compulsion that we never, ever get out of here. I like what you said about your book. You didn't know how to get out of your book. You were trying to figure out how to get out of it. You know, leaving is a hard thing to do, and you have to do it well in books and in life. And I don't know that we've ever left the Civil War. I don't know. So I don't know how to answer your question, except mm-hmm. that I think I share it on some level. I wonder about it a great deal. What am I looking at? I often wonder, am I looking at the present? Probably not.
All right, you guys. Let's thank these two so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Maggie.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.